he added. "There would be no fee involved," said Raymond. "But I'm sure you'll be able to repay me in kind sometime in the future." "Got the picture," said Edwards, touching the side of his nose with a forefinger. "What do I do next?" "You go back to Liverpool and hope that I'm better on an away pitch than your team." Norman Edwards put on an old raincoat and started to button it up. He smiled at Raymond. "I may have been appalled by your book, Ray, but it doesn't mean I didn't admire it." The speaker looked down at the front bench. "Mr. Andrew Fraser?"
"Number 17, sir," said Andrew.
The speaker looked down to check over the question, seeking a Home Office answer. Simon rose to the dispatch box, opened his file and said,
"Yes, sir."
"Mr. Andrew Fraser," called the speaker again.
Andrew rose from his place on the opposition front bench to put his supplementary.
"May I thank the Minister for agreeing to an inquiry so quickly, and ask him that if he discovers an injustice has been done to my constituent, Mr. Paddy O'Halloran, that the Home Secretary will order a retrial immediately."
Simon rose again.
"Yes, sir.
I'm grateful to the Honourable Gentleman,"
said Andrew, half rising from his place. All over in less than a minute. But older members who listened to the brief exchange between Fraser and Karslake in the House that day had no doubt that considerable preparation had gone into that minute from both sides.
"The damn man missed another three-line whip, Charles. It must be the last time. You've been protecting him for far too long."
"It won't happen again," promised Charles, convincingly. "I would like to give him one more chance. Allow him that."
"You're very loyal to him," said the Chief Whip. "But next time I'm going to see Karslake myself and get to the bottom of it."
"It won't happen again," repeated Charles.
"Huh?" said the Chief Whip. "Next problem is, are there any clauses on the European bill that we should be worried about next week?"
"Yes," replied Charles. "This haulage clause that Raymond Gould is fighting. He made a brilliant case on the floor of the House and got all his own side and half of ours backing him."
"He's not the sponsored MP for the haulage union," said the Chief Whip, surprised.
"No, the unions obviously felt Tom Carson wouldn't help the cause, and he's hopping mad at the slight."
"Clever of them to pick Gould. He improves as a speaker every time I hear him, and no one can fault him when it comes to a point of law."
"So we'd better face the fact that we're going to lose the clause?"
"Never. We'll redraft the damn thing so that it's acceptable and seen to be compassionate. It's not a bad time to be the defender of the union interests. That way we'll keep Gould from getting all the credit. I'll speak to the PM tonight. And don't forget what I said about Karslake."
Charles returned to his office and realized that in future he would have to be more careful about telling Simon Karslake when he was paired for the European bill. He suspected he had carried this ploy as far as he could for now. Simon had read the final report prepared by his department on the O'Halloran case while Elizabeth was trying to get to sleep. He only had to go over the details once to realize that he would have to order a retrial and institute a full investigation into the past record of the police officers who had been involved in the case. When Andrew heard the news and that the retrial would be held in London, he asked Raymond Gould to represent O'Halloran. "Praise indeed," said Raymond, who still considered Andrew among the Commons' finest orators. He somehow managed to fit O'Halloran into his busy schedule. The trial was in its third day when Mr. Justice Commons, after listening to Mrs. Bloxham's evidence, stopped proceedings and instructed the jury to return a verdict of not guilty. Andrew received praise from all quarters of the House, but he was quick to acknowledge the support given him by Simon Karslake and the Home Office. The Times even wrote a leader the next day on the proper use of influence by a constituency MP. Some months later, the court awarded O'Halloran £25,000 in compensation. The only drawback Andrew's success caused was that every convict's mother north of Hadrian's Wall queued to tell him about her innocent son at his fortnightly surgery, but during the year he only took one seriously, and once again began to check into the details. During the long, hot summer of 1972, clause after clause of the European bill was voted on, often through the night. On some occasions, the government managed majorities of only five or six, but somehow the bill remained intact. Charles would often arrive home at Eaton Square at 3 in the morning to find Fiona asleep, only to leave again before she had woken. Veterans of the House, both servants and elected, confirmed that they had never experienced anything like it since the Second World War. And, just as suddenly, the last vote was taken and the marathon was over. The European bill was through the Commons and on its way to the Upper House to receive their Lordship's approval. Charles wondered what he would do with all the hours that were suddenly left him in the day. When the bill finally received the royal assent in October, the Chief Whip held a celebration lunch at the Carlton Club in St. James to thank all his team. "And in particular, Charles Seymour," he said, raising his glass during an impromptu speech. When the lunch broke up, the Chief Whip offered Charles a lift back to the Commons in his official car. They travelled along Piccadilly, down Haymarket, through Trafalgar Square, and into Whitehall. Just as the Commons came into sight, the Black Rover turned into Downing Street, as Charles assumed to drop the Chief Whip at number 12. But as the car stopped, the Chief Whip said,
"The Prime Minister is expecting you in 5 minutes.
"What? Why?" said Charles, as he joined his colleague outside number 10.
"Timed it rather well, didn't I?"
said the Chief Whip, and headed off towards number 12. Charles stood alone in front of number 10. The door was opened by a man in a long black coat.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Seymour."
The Prime Minister saw Charles in his study, and, as ever, wasted no time on small talk.
"Thank you for all the hard work you've put in on the European bill."
"It was a tremendous challenge," said Charles, searching for words.
"As will be your next job," said Mr. Heath. "I want you to take over as one of the Ministers of State at the Department of Trade and Industry."
Charles was speechless.
"With all the problems we're going to encounter with the trade unions during the next few months, that should keep you fully occupied."
"It certainly will," said Charles. He still hadn't been asked to sit down, but as the Prime Minister was now rising from behind his desk, it was clear that the meeting was over.
"You and Fiona must come and have dinner at number 10, as soon as you've settled into your new department," said the Prime Minister as they walked towards the door.
"Thank you," Charles said. As he stepped back onto Downing Street, a driver opened the black door of a shiny Austin Westminster. It was several moments before Charles realized the car was his.
"The Commons, sir?"
"No, I'd like to return to Eaton Square for a few minutes," he said, sitting back and enjoying the thought of tackling his new job. The car drove past the Commons, up Victoria Street, and on to Eaton Square. He wanted to tell Fiona that all the hard work had been rewarded. He felt guilty about how little he had seen of her lately, although he could not believe it would be much better now that he was to be involved in trade union legislation. How much he still hoped for a son. Perhaps even that would prove possible now. The car came to a halt outside the Georgian House. Charles ran up the steps and into the hall. He could hear his wife's voice from the first floor. He took the wide staircase in bounds of two and three at a time and threw open the bedroom door.
"I'm the new Minister of State at the Department of Trade and Industry," he announced to Fiona, who was lying in bed.
Alexander Dalgliesh looked up. He showed no sign of interest in Charles's elevation. When Andrew rang Angus Sinclair at the Procurator Fiscal's office to find that nothing was known of Ricky Hodge and that Sinclair was able to confirm that he had no criminal record, Andrew felt he had stumbled on a case with international implications. As Ricky Hodge was in a Turkish jail, any inquiries had to be made through the Foreign Office. Andrew did not have the same relationship with the Foreign Secretary as he did with Simon, so he felt the direct approach would be best, and put down a question to be answered in the House. He worded it carefully. What action does the Foreign Secretary intend to take over the confiscation of a British passport from a constituent of the Honourable Member for Edinburgh Carlton, details of which have been supplied to him? When the question came in front of the House on the following Wednesday, the Foreign Secretary rose to answer the question himself. He stood at the dispatch box and peered over his half-moon spectacles and said,
Her Majesty's Government are pursuing this matter through the usual diplomatic channels.
Andrew was quickly on his feet. Does the Right Honourable Gentleman realise that my constituent has been in a Turkish prison for 6 months and has still not been charged?
Yes, sir, replied the Foreign Secretary. I have asked the Turkish Embassy to supply the Foreign Office with more details of the case.
Andrew leaped up again. How long will my constituent have to be forgotten in Ankara before the Foreign Secretary does more than ask for the details of his case? The Foreign Secretary rose again, showing no sign of annoyance.
I will report those findings to the Honourable Member as quickly as possible.
When? Tomorrow? Next week? Next year? Andrew shouted angrily. When? Joined in a chorus of Labour backbenchers. But the Speaker called for the next question above the uproar. Within the hour, Andrew received a handwritten note from the Foreign Office. It read, If Mr. Fraser would be kind enough to telephone, the Foreign Secretary would be delighted to make an appointment to see him. Andrew phoned from the Commons and was invited to join the Foreign Secretary in Whitehall immediately. The Foreign Office, known as the Palazzo by its inmates, has an atmosphere of its own. Although Andrew had worked in a government department as a minister, he was still struck by its grandeur. He was met at the courtyard entrance and guided along yards of marble corridors before climbing a fine double staircase, at the top of which he was greeted by the Foreign Secretary's principal private secretary.
Sir Alec will see you immediately, Mr. Fraser, he said,
and led Andrew past the magnificent pictures and tapestries which lined the way. He was taken into a beautifully proportioned room. The Foreign Secretary stood in front of an Adam fireplace, over which hung a portrait of Lord Palmerston.
Fraser, how kind of you to come at such short notice. I do hope it's not caused you any inconvenience.
Platitudes, thought Andrew. Next, the silly man will be mentioning my father.
I don't think we've met before, but of course I have known your father for many years. Won't you sit down?
I realize you're a busy man. Can we get to the point at issue, Foreign Secretary? Andrew demanded.
Of course, Sir Alec said courteously. Forgive me for taking up so much of your time.
Without a further word, he handed Andrew a file marked Richard M. Hodge, Confidential.
Although members of Parliament are not subject to the Official Secrets Act, I know you will respect the fact that this file is classified.
Another bluff, thought Andrew. He flicked back the cover. It was true, exactly as he had suspected. Ricky Hodge had never been arrested or charged. He turned the page. Rome, child prostitution. Marseille, narcotics. Paris, blackmail. Page after page, ending in Turkey, where Hodge had been found in possession of 4 pounds of heroin, which he had been selling in small packets on the black market. In his 29 years, Ricky Hodge had spent 11 of the last 14 in foreign jails. Andrew closed the file and could feel the sweat on his forehead. It was some moments before he spoke.
I apologize, Foreign Secretary, he said. I have made a fool of myself.
When I was a young man, said Sir Alec, I made a similar mistake on behalf of a constituent. Ernie Bevin was Foreign Secretary at the time. He could have crucified me in the House with the knowledge he had. Instead, he revealed everything over a drink in this room. I sometimes wish the public could see members in their quiet moments as well as in their rowdy ones.
Andrew thanked Sir Alec and walked thoughtfully back to the house. The Evening Standard poster outside the Commons caught his eye. O'Halloran arrested again. He bought a copy, stood by the railings, and began reading. Paddy O'Halloran had been detained in a Glasgow police station and charged with robbing the Bank of Scotland and Sarkie Hall Street. Andrew wondered if his friends would allege it was another frame-up by the police, until he read the next paragraph. O'Halloran was arrested, leaving the bank in possession of a shotgun and £25,000 in used notes. He said, when apprehended by the police, "I've just been clearing my account." At home, Louise told him that Ricky Hodge had done him a favour.
"How's that possible?" asked Andrew.
"You won't take yourself so seriously in future," she smiled. When Andrew conducted his next surgery in Edinburgh 2 weeks later, he was surprised to see that Mrs. Bloxham had made an appointment. As he greeted her at the door, he was even more surprised. She was wearing a bright crimpline dress and a new pair of squeaky brown leather shoes. She also looked as if Our Blessed Lady might have to wait a few more years to receive her after all. Andrew motioned her to a seat.
"I came to thank you, Mr. Fraser," she said, once she was settled.
"What for?" asked Andrew.
"For sending that nice young man round from Christie's. They auctioned great-grandma's table for me. I couldn't believe my luck. It fetched £1,400.
Andrew smiled.
"So it don't matter about the stain on the dress any more."
She paused.
"It even made up for having to eat off the floor for 3 months.
Simon steered the new Boundary Commission recommendations unspectacularly through the House as an order in council, and suddenly he had lost his own constituency. His colleagues in Coventry were understanding and nursed those wards that would become theirs at the next election in order that he might spend more time searching for a new seat. 7 seats became available during the year, but Simon was only interviewed for 2 of them. Both were almost on the Scottish border, and both put him in second place. He began to appreciate what it must feel like for an Olympic favourite to be awarded the silver medal. Ronnie Nethercott's monthly board reports began to paint an increasingly sombre picture, thus reflecting in real life what the politicians were decreeing in Parliament. Ronnie had decided to postpone going public until the climate was more advantageous. Simon couldn't disagree with the judgment, but when he checked his special overdraft facility, the interest on his loans had pushed the figure in red to over £90,000. When unemployment first passed the million mark, and Ted Heath ordered a pay and prices freeze, strikes broke out all over the country. The new parliamentary session in the autumn was dominated by the issue of a prices and incomes policy. Charles Seymour became involved in putting the case for the government. While he didn't always win every argument, he was now so well briefed on his subject that he no longer feared making a fool of himself at the dispatch box. Raymond Gould and Andrew Fraser both made passionate speeches on behalf of the unions, but the Conservative majority beat them again and again. However, the Prime Minister was moving inexorably towards a head-on clash with the unions and an early general election. When all 3 party conferences were over, members returned to the Commons, aware that it was likely to be their last session before the general election. It was openly being said in the corridors that all the Prime Minister was waiting for was a catalyst. The miners provided it. In the middle of a bleak winter, they called an all-out strike for more pay in defiance of the government's new trade union legislation. In a television interview, the Prime Minister told the nation that with unemployment at an unprecedented 2,294,448 and the country on a 3-day week, he had to call an election to ensure that the rule of law be maintained. The inner cabinet advised Heath Mr. Plump for the 28th of February, 1974. Who runs the country? Became the Tory theme, but seemed only to emphasise class differences rather than uniting the country as Edward Heath had hoped. Andrew Fraser had his doubts, but he faced a different threat in his own constituency, where the Scottish Nationalists were using the quarrel between the two major parties to promote their own cause. He returned to Scotland to be warned by his father that the Scottish Nationalists were no longer a joke, and that he would be facing a hard campaign against the robust local candidate, Jock Macpherson. Raymond Gould travelled back to Leeds, confident that the north-east industrial area would not tolerate Heath's high-handedness. Charles felt sure that the people would back any party which had shown the courage to stand up to the unions, although the left wing, led vociferously by Tom Carson, made a great play of the two-nations issue, insisting that the government were out to crush the Labour movement once and for all. Charles drove down to Sussex to find his supporters glad of the chance to put those lazy trade unionists in their place. Simon, with no seat to fight, worked on in the Home Office right up to the day of the election, convinced that his career was facing only a temporary setback. "I'll fight the first by-election that comes up," he promised Elizabeth. "Even if it's a mining seat in South Wales," she replied. Many months had passed before Charles had found it possible even to sustain a conversation with Fiona for any length of time. Neither wanted a divorce, both citing the ailing Earl of Bridgewater as their reason, although inconvenience and loss of face were nearer the truth. In public, it would have been hard to detect the change in their relationship, since they had never been given to overt affection. Charles gradually became aware that it was possible for marriages to have been over for years without outsiders knowing it. Certainly the old Earl never found out, because even on his deathbed he told Fiona to hurry up and produce an heir. "Do you think you'll ever forgive me?" Fiona once asked her husband. "Never," he replied, with a finality that encouraged no further discourse. During the three-week election campaign in Sussex, they both went about their duties with a professionalism that masked their true feelings. "How is your husband bearing up?" someone would inquire. "Much enjoying the campaign and looking forward to returning to government," was Fiona's stock reply. "And how is dear Lady Fiona?" Charles was continuously asked. "Never better than when she's helping in the constituency," was his. On Sundays, at one church after another, he read the lesson with confidence, while she sang "Fight the Good Fight" in a clear contralto. The demands of a rural constituency are considerably different from those of a city. Every village, however small, expects the member to visit them and to recall the local chairman's names. Subtle changes were taking place. Fiona no longer whispered the names in Charles's ear. Charles no longer turned to her for advice. During the campaign, Charles would ring the photographer on the local newspaper to discover which events his editor had instructed him to cover that day. With the list of places and times in hand, Charles would arrive on each occasion a few minutes before the photographer. The Labour candidate complained officially to the local editor that Mr. Seymour's photograph was never out of the paper. "If you were present at those functions, we would be only too happy to publish your photo," said the editor. "But they never invite me," cried the Labour candidate. "They don't invite Seymour either," the editor wanted to say, "but he somehow manages to be there." It was never far from the editor's mind that his proprietor was a Tory peer, so he kept his mouth shut. All the way up to election day, Charles and Fiona opened bazaars, attended dinners, drew raffles, and only just stopped short of kissing babies. Once, when Fiona asked him, Charles admitted that he hoped to be moved to the Foreign Office as a Minister of State, and perhaps to be made a Privy Councillor. On the last day of February, they dressed in silence and went off to their local polling station to vote. The photographer was there on the steps to take their picture. They stood closer together than they had for some weeks, looking like a smart register office couple. Charles knew it would be the main photograph on the front page of the Sussex Gazette the following day, as surely as he knew the Labour candidate would be relegated to a half-column mention on the inside page, not far from the obituaries. The Count, in a rural seat, is always taken the following morning, at a more leisurely pace than is customary for its city cousins. Sir Charles anticipated that by the time he arrived in the town hall, the Conservative majority in the House would already be assured. But it was not to be, and the result still hung in the balance that Friday morning. Edward Heath did not concede when the newscasters predicted he would fail to be given the overall majority he required. Charles spent the days striding around the town hall with an anxious look on his face. The little piles of votes soon became larger, and it was obvious that he would hold the seat with at least his usual 21,000, or was it 22,000, majority. He could never remember the exact figure. But as the day progressed, it became more and more difficult to assess the national verdict. The last result came in from Northern Ireland a little after 4 o'clock that afternoon, and a BBC commentator announced, Labour, 301, Conservative, 296, Liberal, 14, Ulster Unionists, 11, Scottish Nationalists, 7, Welsh Nationalists, 2, Others, 4. Ted Heath invited the Liberal leader to join him at Downing Street for talks, in the hope that they could form a coalition. The Liberals demanded a firm commitment to electoral reform, and in particular to proportional representation by the next election. Heath knew he could never get his backbenchers to deliver. On the Monday morning, he told the Queen in her drawing room at Buckingham Palace that he was unable to form a government. So she called for Harold Wilson. He accepted her commission and drove back to Downing Street to enter the front door. Heath left by the back. By the Tuesday afternoon, every member, having watched the drama unfold, had returned to London. Raymond had increased his majority and now hoped that the Prime Minister had long since forgotten his resignation and would offer him a job. Andrew had had the hard and unpleasant fight with Jock Macpherson, just as his father had predicted, and held on to his seat by only 2,229. Charles, still unsure of the exact majority by which he had won, drove back to London, resigned to opposition. The one compensation was that he would be reinstated on the board of Seymour's, where the knowledge he had gained as a Minister of Trade and Industry could only be of value. Simon left the Home Office on the 1st of March 1974 with little more than an empty red box to show for 9 years as a parliamentarian. Book 3, 1974 to 1977. Ministers of State. Chapter 16. His diary looks rather full at the moment, Mr. Charles.
Well, as soon as it's convenient, Charles replied over the phone.
He held on as he heard the pages being turned.
12th of March at 10:30, Mr. Charles.
But that's nearly a fortnight away, he said, irritated.
Mr. Spencer has only just returned from the States, and...
Well, how about lunch, then? At my club, Charles interrupted.
That couldn't be until after the 19th of March.
Very well, then, said Charles. 12th of March at 10:30. During the 14-day wait, Charles had ample time to become frustrated by his seemingly aimless role in opposition. No car came to pick him up and whisk him away to an office where real work had to be done. Worse, no one sought his opinion any longer on matters that affected the nation. He was going through a sharp bout of what is known as ex-minister's blues.
This ends side one of cassette five. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
He was relieved when the day for the appointment with Derek Spencer at last came round. But although he arrived on time, he was kept waiting for 10 minutes before the chairman's secretary took him through. "Good to see you after so long," said Spencer, coming round his desk to greet him. "It must be nearly 6 years since you visited the bank." "Yes, I suppose it is," said Charles. "But looking around the old place, it feels like yesterday. You've been fully occupied, no doubt." "Like a cabinet minister, but I hope with better results." They both laughed. "Of course, I've kept in touch with what's been happening at the bank." "Have you?" said Spencer. "Yes. I've read all the reports you've sent out over the past years, not to mention the Financial Times coverage. I hope you feel we've progressed satisfactorily in your absence." "Oh, yes," said Charles, still standing. "Very impressive." "Well, now what can I do for you?" asked the chairman, returning to his seat. "Simple enough," said Charles, finally taking an unoffered chair. "I wish to be reinstated on the board." There was a long silence. "Well, it's not quite that easy, Charles. I've just recently appointed 2 new directors, and..." "Of course it's that easy," said Charles, his tone changing. "You have only to propose my name at the next meeting, and it will go through, especially as you haven't a member of the family on the board at the present time." "We have, as a matter of fact. Your brother, the Earl of Bridgewater, has become a non-executive director."
"What?
Rupert never told me," said Charles.
"Neither did you."
"True, but things have changed since..." "Nothing has changed except my estimation of the value of your word," said Charles, suddenly realizing that Spencer had never intended he should return to the board.
"You gave me your assurance. I won't be spoken to like this in my own office. If you're not careful, the next place I shall do it will be in your boardroom. Now, will you honor your undertaking or not?"
"I don't have to listen to threats from you, Seymour. Get out of my office before I have you removed. I can assure you that you will never sit on the board again as long as I'm chairman."
Charles turned and marched out, slamming the door as he left. He wasn't sure with whom to discuss the problem, and returned immediately to Eaton Square to consider a plan of campaign.
"What brings you home in the middle of the afternoon?" asked Fiona.
Charles hesitated, considered the question, and then joined his wife in the kitchen and told her everything that had happened at the bank. Fiona continued to grate some cheese as she listened to her husband.
"Well, one thing is certain," she said, not having spoken for several minutes, but delighted that Charles had confided in her. "After that fracas, you can't both be on the board."
"So, what do you think I ought to do, old girl?"
Fiona smiled. It was the first time he'd called her that for nearly 2 years.
"Every man has his secrets," she said. "I wonder what Mr. Spencer's are."
"He's such a dull middle-class fellow, I doubt if..."
"I've just had a letter from Seymour's bank," interrupted Fiona.
"What about?"
"Only a shareholder's circular. It seems Margaret Trubshaw is retiring after 12 years as the board secretary. Rumour has it she wanted to do 5 more years, but the chairman has someone else in mind. I think I might have lunch with her."
Charles returned his wife's smile. Andrew's appointment as Minister of State at the Home Office came as no surprise to anyone, except his 3-year-old son, who quickly discovered how to empty any red boxes that were left unlocked, refilling them with marbles or sweets, and even managing to fit a football into one. As Robert didn't fully understand, for your eyes only, it didn't seem to make a lot of difference that cabinet committee papers were sometimes found glued together with old bubble gum.
"Can you remove that latest stain in the red box?"
"Good heavens, what caused it?"
asked Louise, staring down at a jelly-like blob.
"Frog spawn," said Andrew, grinning.
"He's a brainwashed Russian spy," warned Louise, "with a mental age about the same as most of your colleagues in the house. Yes, I'll remove the stain if you sit down and write that letter."
Andrew nodded his agreement. Among the many letters of commiseration Simon received when he didn't return to the house was one from Andrew Fraser. Simon could imagine him sitting in his old office and implementing the decisions he had been involved in making just a few weeks before. There was also a letter from Ronnie Nethercott inviting him to return to the board of Nethercott and Company at £5,000 a year, which even Elizabeth acknowledged as a generous gesture. It was not long before Ronnie Nethercott had made Simon an executive director of the company. Simon enjoyed negotiating with the trade unions at a level he had not experienced before. Ronnie made it clear how he would have dealt with the commie bastards, given half a chance.
Lock them all up until they learn to do a day's work.
You would have lasted about a week in the House of Commons, Simon told him.
After a week with all those windbags, I'd have been only too happy to return to the real world.
Simon smiled. Ronnie, he felt, was like so many others, imagining all members of Parliament were unemployable, except the one they knew. Raymond waited until the last government appointment was announced before he finally gave up any hope of the job. Several leading political journalists pointed out that he'd been left on the back benches while lesser men had been given government posts, but it was scant comfort. Reluctantly, he returned to Lincoln's Inn to continue his practice at the bar. Harold Wilson, starting his third administration, made it clear that he would govern as long as possible before calling an election. But as he did not have an overall majority in the House, few members believed that he could hold out for more than a matter of months. Fiona returned home after her lunch with Miss Trubshaw, with a large Cheshire Cat grin on her face. It remained firmly in place during the hour she had to wait for Charles to get back from the Commons after the last division.
"You look pleased with yourself," said Charles, shaking out his umbrella before closing the front door.
His wife stood in the hallway, her arms crossed.
"How has your day been?" she asked.
"So-so," said Charles, wanting to hear the news. "But what about you?"
"Oh, pleasant enough. I had coffee with your mother this morning. She seems very well, a little cold in the head. Otherwise..."
"To hell with my mother! How did your lunch with Miss Trubshaw go?"
"I wondered how long it would take you to get round to that."
She continued to wait just as long as it took for them to walk into the drawing-room and sit down.
"After 17 years as secretary to your father, and 12 years as secretary to the board, there isn't much Miss Trubshaw doesn't know about Seymour's or its present chairman," Fiona began.
"So, what did you discover?"
"Which do you want to hear about first? The name of his mistress or the number of his Swiss bank account?"
Fiona revealed everything she had learned over her 2-hour lunch, explaining that Miss Trubshaw usually only drank fortified wine, but on this occasion she had downed most of a vintage bottle of pomade. Charles's smile grew wider and wider as each fact came pouring out. To Fiona, he looked like a boy who has been given a box of chocolates and keeps discovering another layer underneath.
"Well done, old girl,"
he said when she'd come to the end of her tale.
"But how do I get all the proof I need?"
"I've made a deal with our Miss Trubshaw."
"You what?"
"A deal. With Miss Trubshaw. You get the proof if she remains as secretary to the board for a further 5 years, and no loss of benefit to her pension."
"Is that all she wants?"
said Charles, guardedly.
"And the price of another lunch at the Savoy Grill when you're invited back on the board."
Unlike many of his Labour colleagues, Raymond now enjoyed dressing up in white tie and tails and mixing with London society. An invitation to the annual bankers' banquet at the Guildhall was no exception. The Prime Minister was the guest of honour, and Raymond wondered if he would drop a hint as to how long he expected the parliamentary session to last before he felt he had to call an election. At the pre-dinner drinks, Raymond had a quick word with the Lord Mayor before becoming involved in a conversation with a circuit court judge on the problems of the parity of sentencing. When dinner was announced, Raymond found his seat on one of the long fingers stretching away from the top table. He checked his place card. Raymond Gould, QC, MP. On his right was the chairman of Chloride, Michael Edwards, and on his left, an American banker who had just taken up an appointment in the city. Raymond found Michael Edwards' views on how the Prime Minister should tackle the nationalized industries fascinating, but he devoted far more of his attention to the Eurobond manager from Chase Manhattan. She must have been 30, Raymond decided, if only because of her elevated position at the bank and her claim to have been an undergraduate at Wellesley at the time of Kennedy's death. He would have put Kate Garthwaite at far younger, and was not surprised to learn she played tennis in the summer and swam every day during the winter. To keep her weight down, she confided. She had a warm, oval face, and her dark hair was cut in what Raymond thought was a Mary Quant style. Her nose turned up slightly at the end, and would have cost a lot of money for a plastic surgeon to reproduce. And there was no chance of seeing her legs, as they were covered by a long dress. But what he could see left Raymond more than interested. "I see there's an MP behind your name, Mr. Gould. May I ask which party you represent?" she asked, in an accent heard more often in Boston. "I'm a socialist, Mrs. Garthwaite. Where do your sympathies lie on this occasion?" "I would have voted Labour at the last election if I had been qualified," she declared. "Should I be surprised?" he teased. "You certainly should. My ex-husband is a Republican congressman." He was about to ask his next question when the toastmaster called for silence. For the first time, Raymond turned his eyes to the top table and the Prime Minister. Harold Wilson's speech stuck firmly to economic problems and the role of the Labour government in the city, and gave no clue as to the timing of the next election. Nevertheless, Raymond considered it a worthwhile evening. He had made a useful contact with the chairman of a large public company, and he had acquired Kate's telephone number. The chairman of Seymour's reluctantly agreed to see him a second time, but it was obvious from the moment Charles walked in, when no hand was proffered, that Derek Spencer intended it to be a short interview. "I thought I ought to see you personally," said Charles, as he settled back in the comfortable leather chair and slowly lit a cigarette, "rather than raise my query at the AGM next month." The first sign of apprehension began to show on the chairman's face, but he said nothing. "I'm rather keen to discover why the bank should pay out a monthly check of £400 to an employee called Miss Janet Darrow, whom I've never come across, although it appears she has been on the payroll for over 5 years. The checks, it seems, have been going to a branch of Lloyd's in Kensington." Derek Spencer's face became flushed. "What I'm at a loss to discover," continued Charles, after he had inhaled deeply, "is what services Miss Darrow has been supplying to the bank. They must be quite impressive to have earned her £25,000 over the last 5 years. I appreciate that this is a small amount when you consider the bank's turnover of £123 million last year, but my grandfather instilled in me at an early age the belief that if one took care of the pennies, the pounds would take care of themselves." Still, Derek Spencer said nothing, although beads of sweat had appeared on his forehead. Suddenly, Charles's tone changed. "If I find I'm not a member of the board by the time of the annual general meeting, I feel it will be my duty to point out this slight discrepancy in the bank's accounts to the other shareholders present." "You're a bastard, Seymour," the chairman said quietly. "Now, that is not accurate. I'm the second son of the former chairman of this bank, and I bear a striking resemblance to my father, although everyone says I have my mother's eyes." "What's the deal?" "No deal. You will merely keep to your original agreement and see that I'm reinstated on the board before the AGM. You will also cease any further payments to Miss Janet Darrow
immediately.
If I agree, will you swear never to mention this matter to anyone again?
I will. And unlike you, I'm in the habit of keeping my word.
Charles rose from his chair, leaned over the desk, and stubbed out his cigarette in the chairman's ashtray.
Andrew Fraser was surprised when he heard that Jock McPherson wanted to see him. The two men had never been on good terms since McPherson had failed to be elected to the Scottish Labour Party Executive Committee and had then left the party to stand against him at Edinburgh Calton. Since McPherson had switched his allegiance, they had barely been on speaking terms. However, Andrew realised it would be foolish not to see him after the SNP's sweeping successes in the election. Andrew was even more surprised when McPherson asked if all seven SNP members of Parliament could also attend the meeting, not in Andrew's office, but somewhere private. He agreed, even more mystified. McPherson and his band of renegade Scots arrived together at Cheyne Walk, looking as though they'd already held a meeting between themselves. Andrew offered them a variety of seats, including the dining room chairs, a puff, and even the kitchen stool, apologising that his London flat had never been intended to accommodate nine men in the drawing room. While the men settled themselves, Andrew remained standing by the mantelpiece, facing Jock McPherson, who had obviously been chosen to act as their spokesman.
"I'll get straight to the point," McPherson began. "We want you to fight under the SNP banner at the next election." Andrew tried not to show his disbelief, and began, "I don't feel..." "Hear me out," said McPherson, raising his massive palms. "We want you to contest the Edinburgh Calton seat not just as a Scottish nationalist candidate, but as leader of the party." Andrew still couldn't believe what he was hearing, but remained silent. "We're convinced you'll lose your seat in any case if you stand as a socialist," McPherson continued. "But we realise that there are many people in Scotland who, whatever their political views, admire what you've achieved in the 9 years you've been in the House. After all, man, you were brought up and educated in Edinburgh. With you as leader, we believe we could capture 40 to 50 of the 71 seats in Scotland. And I may add that your own party is moving inexorably to the left, a state of affairs that I can't believe you're altogether happy about." Andrew still made no comment. He listened as each one of the MPs put his own view, which became predictable long before the last one had spoken. Every Scottish tone, from a Highland lilt to a Glasgow growl, was represented in the voices. It became clear that they had given the matter considerable thought and were obviously sincere. "I'm very flattered, gentlemen," he began when the last one had said his piece, "and I assure you I will give your offer my serious consideration."
"Thank you," said McPherson. They all stood up like clan leaders in the presence of a new chief.
"We'll wait to hear from you, then," said McPherson. One by one, they shook hands with their host before filing out. As soon as they had left, Andrew went straight into the kitchen, where Robert was still waiting impatiently to play football before going to bed.
In a moment, he said in response to his son's noisy demands. "I'll join you in the garden."
"And what did that lot want?" inquired Louise as she continued to peel the potatoes. Andrew went over the details of their proposition.
"And how did you respond?"
"I didn't. I shall wait a week, and then decline as gracefully as possible."
"What made you decide against the offer so quickly?"
"I don't like being told by Jock McPherson, or anyone else, for that matter, that I'll lose my seat at the next election if I don't fall in with their plans." He headed towards the kitchen door. "I'll be back to the Red Box as soon as I've scored a couple of goals against Mac Paley." A moment later, he joined Robert in the garden.
"Now listen, clever boots. I'm going to teach you how to feint a pass so that your opponent goes one way while you go the other."
"Sounds just like politics to me," muttered Louise, watching them out of the kitchen window. 27 Eaton Square, London SW1, 23rd of April, 1974. Dear Derek, thank you for your letter of the 18th of April and your kind invitation to rejoin the Board of Seymour's. I am delighted to accept and look forward to working with you again. Yours sincerely, Charles Seymour. Fiona checked the wording and nodded. Short and to the point. Shall I post it? Yes, please, said Charles as the phone rang. He picked it up. 730-9712. Charles Seymour speaking. Oh, hello, Charles. It's Simon Carslick. Hello, Simon, said Charles, trying to sound pleased to hear from his former colleague. What's it like out there in the real world? Not much fun, which is exactly why I'm phoning. I've been shortlisted for Pucklebridge, Sir Michael Harbour Baker's seat. He's nearly 70 and has decided not to stand again at the next election. As his constituency touches the south border of yours, I thought you might be able to put in a word for me again. Delighted, said Charles. I'll speak to the chairman tonight. You can rely on me. And good luck. It would be nice to have you back in the house. Simon gave him his home number, which Charles repeated slowly, as if he were writing it down. I'll be in touch, said Charles. I really appreciate your help. Simon put down the phone. Elizabeth looked up from her copy of The Lancet. I don't trust that man, she said. A woman's intuition again, said Simon, smiling. You were wrong about Ronnie Nethercott. That's yet to be proved. It was several days before Kate Garthwaite agreed to see Raymond again, and when she eventually joined him for dinner at the house, she was not overwhelmed or flattered, and she certainly didn't hang on his every word. She was lively, fun, intelligent, and well-informed, and they began to see each other regularly. As the months passed, Raymond found himself missing her at weekends when he was in Leeds with Joyce. Kate enjoyed her independence and made none of the demands on him that Stephanie had, never once suggesting he spend more time with her or that she might leave clothes behind in the flat. Raymond sipped his coffee. That was a memorable meal, he said, falling back into the sofa. Only by the standards of the House of Commons, replied Kate. Raymond put his arm round her shoulder before kissing her gently on the lips. What? Rampant sex as well as cheap Beaujolais? She exclaimed, stretching over and pouring herself some more coffee. I wish you wouldn't always make a joke of our relationship, said Raymond, stroking the back of her hair. I have to, said Kate quietly. Why? Raymond turned to face her. Because I'm frightened of what might happen if I take it seriously. Raymond leaned over and kissed her again. Don't be frightened. You're the best thing that's happened to me in my whole life. That's what I'm worried about, said Kate, turning away. Charles sat through the annual general meeting in silence. The chairman made his report for the year ending March 1974, before welcoming two new directors to the board and the return of Charles Seymour. There were several questions from the floor which Derek Spencer had no trouble in handling. As Charles had promised, there was not even a hint of Miss Janet Darrow. Miss Trumpshaw had let Fiona know that the payment had been stopped, and also mentioned that she was still worried that her contract was coming to an end on the 1st of July. When the chairman brought the AGM to a close, Charles asked courteously if he could spare him a moment. Of course, said Spencer, looking relieved that the meeting had gone through without a hitch. What can I do for you? I think it might be wiser to talk in the privacy of your office. The chairman glanced at him sharply, but led him back to his room. Charles settled himself comfortably in the leather chair once more and removed some papers from his inside pocket. Peering down at them, he asked, What does BX4120722, Bank Rombert, Zurich, mean to you?
You said you would never mention
Miss Darrow, said Charles, and I shall keep my word. But now, as a director of the bank, I'm trying to find out what BX4120722 means to you.
You know damn well what it means, said the chairman, banging his clenched fist on the desk.
I know it's your private, Charles emphasized the last word, account in Zurich.
You could never prove anything,
said Derek Spencer, defiantly.
Oh, I agree with you, but what I am able to prove, said Charles, shuffling through the papers that were resting on his lap, is that you've been using Seymour's money to do private deals, leaving the profit in your Zurich account without informing the board.
I've done nothing that will harm the bank, and you know it.
I know the money has been returned with interest, and I could never prove the bank had suffered any loss. Nevertheless, the board might take a dim view of your activities, remembering they pay you $40,000 a year to make profits for the bank, not for yourself.
When they saw all the figures, they would have worst rapped me over the knuckles.
I doubt if the Director of Public Prosecutions would take the same lenient attitude if he saw these documents, said Charles, holding up the papers that had been resting on his lap.
You'd ruin the bank's name.
And you would probably spend the next 10 years in jail. If, however, you did get away with it, you would be finished in the city, and by the time your legal fees had been paid, there wouldn't be much left of that nest egg in Zurich.
So, what do you want this time? Demanded Spencer, sounding exasperated.
Your job, said Charles.
My job? Said Spencer in disbelief. Do you imagine because you've been a junior minister you're capable of running a successful merchant bank? He added scornfully.
I didn't say I would run it. I can buy a competent chief executive to do that.
Then what will you be doing?
I shall be the chairman of Seymour's, which will convince city institutions that we wish to continue in the traditions of generations of my family.
You're bluffing, stammered Spencer.
If you're still in this building in 24 hours' time, said Charles, I shall send these to the DPP. There was a long silence.
If I agreed, said Spencer at last, I would expect 2 years' salary as compensation.
1 year, said Charles.
Spencer hesitated, then nodded slowly.
Charles rose to his feet and put the papers resting on his lap back inside his inside pocket. They consisted of nothing more than the morning mail from Sussex Downs.
Simon felt the interview had gone well, but Elizabeth was not so sure. They sat huddled in a room with 5 other candidates and their wives, patiently waiting. He thought back to his answers and to the 8 men and 4 women on the committee.
You must admit it's the most ideal seat I've been considered for, said Simon.
Yes, but the chairman kept eyeing you suspiciously. But Milburn mentioned that he'd been at Eton with Charles Seymour.
That's what worries me, whispered Elizabeth.
15,000 majority at the last election, and only 40 minutes from London. We could even buy a little cottage, if they invite you to represent them.
At least this time we were able to tell them you would be willing to live in the constituency.
So would anyone in their right mind, said Elizabeth.
The chairman came out and asked if Mr. and Mrs. Carslake would be kind enough to return once more to see the committee.
Oh, God, thought Simon. What else can they want to know? It's too near London to be my fault this time, chuckled Elizabeth.
The committee sat and stared at them with long faces.
Ladies and gentlemen, said the chairman, after our lengthy deliberations, I formally propose that Mr. Simon Carslake be invited to contest Pucklebridge at the next election. Those in favour?
All 12 hands went up.
Those against?
Carried unanimously, said the chairman. He then turned to Simon. Do you wish to address your committee? The prospect.